The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Gaitis, Judge Johnson, Judge Kirk, the Honorable Theodore Gaitis presiding.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is May 23rd, 2023, and the court has three oral arguments scheduled. We are just about to begin with our first argument on the calendar today. The case is number A221347, Suzanne Stevens versus John Goodwin as trustee of the Cleone J. Goodwin Revocable Trust Agreement, dated July 17, 1995, as amended et al. And Rodney Goodwin. I know we have three attorneys who will be making appearances this morning. And I see that you're all present, and I know that you've all had your technology tested. So I just have a few words for you, and then we can begin hearing from the attorneys in the case. I'll just note that today's arguments are being held via the Zoom platform. The clock that normally keeps your time on the lectern in the courtroom is actually on the screen this morning. And attorneys, can you see that clock? You can just nod. All right, good. So just a few notes about the timing of your arguments. Appellant will have 15 minutes to present an argument this morning. And then it is my understanding that our respondents will be splitting their time with 10 minutes for the attorney representing Suzanne Goodwin, Ms. Colley, and then 5 minutes for the attorney representing respondent cross appellant, John Goodwin. Do I have that correct? And if I do, you can just nod. Okay. And then finally, appellant will have 5 minutes for a rebuttal argument. When you're not speaking this morning, please do mute your audio. We are making a recording of the arguments, and that recording will be available on our website shortly. But having those who are not speaking muted does help ensure the quality of our recording. And then finally, I'd ask that you introduce yourself and identify the party you're representing before you begin your argument. With that, I think we are ready to hear from our attorneys. We will first hear from attorney representing appellant. You may proceed when you're ready.
Good morning. My name is Dan Bellig, and I represent the appellant Rodney Goodwin. As preliminary remarks, I think what I'd like to do is just set out what I think is sort of the three-step analytical approach to resolving this case. The first step in that approach is asking, what do the trust terms provide with respect to a trigger for the option? Okay, so we looked first to the trust terms, and that's one issue. The next issue is, if the trust terms don't provide any trigger, then what does the common law provide? That's the second step. And third, once you decide whether the trust terms have a trigger or we're applying some sort of common law rule, then how do the facts play into this? Can it be resolved as a matter of law, or do we need a remand for trial with the district court? With respect to the first issue, what do the trust terms provide with respect to a trigger for any deadline in exercising the option? The answer is Article 8, which deals specifically with the option, does not provide any timing deadline itself. What we've heard from the respondents is that that's true, but their position is that the trigger for exercising the option occurs upon the death of the testators. And we know that's not the case, because date of death triggers are all contained in Article 3 of the trusts, and the option or any reference to the option does not appear in there. So if we go back then to Article 8, there's no timing deadline in there, but there is another trigger that appears. It's not one that's dictated by time, but it's dictated by a specific act that the trustees need to do for the option to be presented and then exercised within a reasonable amount of time. And that is that the trustees have to make a formal tender of the option to either Rodney or John Goodwin. And that's something that didn't happen until, well, arguably it didn't happen at all, but this last summer, there's potentially a document that can be construed with that. And then that tender was accepted within a few days.
Can you explain where you see that specific language, counsel? Because I don't really see that.
Right. The language that Article 8 provides is, I direct that my trustees shall grant. So what is happening there is, you know, the parents are saying that the trustees have to take some affirmative act. They have to grant. What the trust Article 8 does not say is that I am presently granting or at the date of death, my sons are granting.
Indirectly, it says that when it says that if my wife survives me, it will be on the date of her death. That certainly seems to indicate that once they're both gone, that's the trigger.
Let me pull up that language, Your Honor. That's the very last part of Article 8C. And that doesn't have to deal with the timing of when the option is triggered. That has to deal with when the option can actually be tendered. So the language that is there, it says this option to purchase shall only apply if my spouse does not survive me or if he does survive me upon his subsequent death. What that is saying, Your Honor, is that the option cannot be tendered while I'm still alive. The mechanism for actually tendering the option appears earlier in Article 8, where it says, I direct that my trustees shall grant to each of my sons. So there's different provisions there. There's one saying, when can potentially the tender be made? That's after death. We don't want you selling this particular farmland while we're still alive, because we want to benefit from the rental income or farm it ourselves. Now, once we're dead, we look to Article 3 to see what has to be done upon death. Nothing in there mentions a deadline for tendering the option. Instead, we have to go back to Article 8, where it's requiring that the trustees give some affirmative act. And we know some affirmative act has to be done because we don't have all the essential terms of the option. So something has to be put together at some point in time that contains all the terms. For example, the option allows the farmland to be sold in pieces or all together. There's also the requirement that they be offered a contract for deed. Some of the terms are contained, but not all of them. So the only way that the option can be exercised is some formal proffer of it is put together. So that's reading the entire Article 8C as a whole.
Mr. Bellick, I have a question about the trust agreement. It's in respondent's addendum. And first of all, is that properly in the record, in the appellate record? Do you have any objection?
The trust agreement, I'm sorry, I cut you off.
Do you have any objection to it being before the court in the respondent's addendum?
Well, so the background of that is that when the case began and the petition was made and the motion to deny the option was made, the trust agreement was never provided to the district court before it made its decision. So it's technically not part of what the district court decided. So when the district court concluded that the trigger is death, it did not have the entire document with which to construe. So we typically construe documents as a whole, and it couldn't do that because no one put the trust agreement into evidence. And the petitioner, Ms. Stevens here, would have had that burden as the moving and petitioning party. Now, having said that, I put it in the district court record as part of a motion to stay enforcement to show that we would have sufficient proceeds to, cover any damage caused by this appeal. And in that regard, I think the trust terms speak for themselves. So if there's no ambiguity in the trust agreement, I don't have a problem with this court considering it in the first instance. But the district court did not have that document when it made its decision.
So the question I was leading up to is, am I correct in understanding that the scenario of a sale to the two sons pursuant to their exercise of this right Is that something that could have been done during his lifetime, but after his wife's death? In other words, I mean, the trustee has a lot of authority to buy and sell assets and so on. And so is it possible that this option was meant to operate both before his death and after his death?
No, I think the last sentence of Article 8C would suggest that the option cannot operate during either of their lifetime. But of course, the testator could potentially, agree to that. They could come to some sort of global agreement where that article is amended, or the beneficiaries all agree, or something like that. And then they could use that mechanism to sell the assets during lifetime.
And why is that so? That it's only, is that because it's in Article 8, or?
That's because of the last sentence of Article 8.
Shall only apply if my spouse does not survive me. She did not.
Yep.
Why does it not apply after her death, but during his lifetime?
Well, if it did, then it doesn't change the analysis, because that would tell us that there would need to be some sort of formal tender, because then we wouldn't know that the subsequent death was a trigger either.
I have a question too. It's described in the fourth line as a quote first right and option to purchase, end quote. Is that same as what is sometimes called a first right of refusal?
Well, it depends. To me, I'm not a real estate specialist, and there may be some special language or magic language that they use. But my read of this is that it's not a right in terms of, hey, we're going to sell the property on these terms to somebody else. Do you want to buy it on those terms first? Instead, it's before we sell it, we have to give you an option to purchase on these specific terms, which would be date of death value along with the contract for deed. I'm not sure if that helps you.
And then one more question, and that is, so the purchase price depends upon the fair market value as finally determined for federal estate tax purposes in connection with my estate, or, and there's an alternative, if there's no federal estate tax valuation. But is there any evidence in the record about when his estate was finalized, or when a fair market value was determined for purposes of federal estate tax purposes? I mean, obviously that wouldn't occur on the day of death. Probably it probably wouldn't occur the day after. I mean, it would occur at some later time. I'm just wondering if we know when that occurred in this case.
There was an appraisal, and again, this wasn't before the district court, because this was part of the motion to stay enforcement. There was an appraisal that was done in July of 2022 for those values. My understanding is there's no evidence in the record at all with respect to anything that occurred prior to this court's decision, the district court's decision denying the option.
I'm sorry, there's no what before?
There's no evidence whatsoever in the record. Okay. Up to the time the court makes its decision denying the option. There's nothing.
Was it understood? And I understand that you have an argument about the lack of evidence. We have a lot of professional statements by attorneys, but was there any discussion by the attorneys about the status of the probate action? Had that been closed out, or was that still pending at that time?
I don't recall that discussion happening on the record, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Counsel, isn't the purpose of a trust to avoid probate?
It is. And the purpose of the trust is to keep assets around longer than the decedent's death. So that's one of the arguments we're making here, is that when you construe this trust document, you have a will which could take you into probate with the real estate. And the purpose of the will is to dispose of the assets upon death in a reasonably quick manner. And here you have a trust where they've put this property to avoid that process. And when you look at that and you look at the protective clause that allows the trust to continue on basically in perpetuity for decades and decades, you have to read that as part of the trust agreement, is there being no date of death trigger with respect to the option.
Am I correct? This is a revocable trust?
That I don't recall offhand, Your Honor.
And, you know, and I'm not. Yeah.
But okay. That would be just during his and her lifetimes. That would be revocable.
Yeah, and I don't recall that issue being raised with respect to how to construe the document. With the few minutes I have remaining, I'd just like to go on to the second part of the analysis, which is if there's no explicit trigger within the document as to the timing of when the option needs to be offered, then you're presented with an issue of first impression. The parties cannot locate any case law indicating what the common law rule is with respect to the deadline for an option that's contained in a trust. And as I noted with Judge Kirk's previous question, because the idea of the trust is to basically maintain property in perpetuity for the beneficiaries, the common law rule needs to be that there's no deadline to exercise the option until there's some attempt to dispose of the trust assets. It's the only way you can read that in the context of a trust that is meant to provide ongoing benefits to the parties. Again, that's an issue of first impression. The only cases that that have been cited by the parties with respect to an option needs to be accepted within a reasonable time period occur when there's actually been a formal tender made. So if there had been a formal tender, you know, many, many years ago, we would be having a different discussion. Then that reasonableness period would have been triggered under a common law, as we've seen in the Dirdall case. But that was never made until last summer and was accepted within a few days.
Counsel, when you referred to the appraisal before, I'm assuming the appraisal that was done in 22 or whatever the date was, valued it at, as of the date of death of Dad. Is that a fair statement? Which would be back in 19 or whenever that was.
Let me pull this up just to be clear for you. I assumed it was date of death, but I'm not seeing that right on the document. So I would have to refer you directly to exhibit one of my affidavit. Quick glance here. One moment. I'm looking at it now and it does say the effective date is 2022. So we wouldn't have that appraisal, it doesn't appear.
Because for purposes of the option, the value would have been the value either on his date of death or the filing of the estate tax and the value that was established there. And it doesn't sound like that occurred. So I'm assuming it would be someone giving, an expert giving a value as of the date of his death.
Right. This, the effective date of this appraisal is July 6, 2022, so it would not be date of death, because I'm reading it at the moment.
I recall something in the record about an understanding that the property had appreciated in value between the date of death and the proceedings in the district court by something like $1 million or something like that. Am I incorrect about that?
That's the generic understanding. Again, with respect to the district court's order, there's no actual evidence. There's a lot of attorney argument, which is not evidence or a factual basis for a court order. But that's the general understanding. And of course, it's the difference, the expected difference in value that is causing, you know, litigation over this. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bellick. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And next, we will turn to counsel for Suzanne Goodwin. Ms. Colley, you may proceed when you're ready. You'll have 10 minutes.
Thank you. Good morning. Molly Hamilton Colley on behalf of respondent Suzanne Stevens. I would like to address the last couple of questions from Judge Kirk and Judge Johnson regarding the appraised value. There is, in fact, evidence of the appraised value as it's contained in Ms. Suzanne Stevens' verified petition. That included that there was an October 25th, 2019 appraisal report, which would have been within the time period following the July death of Nathan Goodwin. Generally, it's just a point of reference. You file your federal estate taxes within 9 months as required by the IRS. But within 3 months after, or 3 or 4 months after the death, there was an appraised report, and that's contained in fact number 15 in the verified petition. The current value from July of 2022 was contained in a motion hearing brief, and that had gone up to $2.78 million for the 320 acres in Nathan Goodwin's trust and $1.5 million for the 180 acres in Ms. Cleone Goodwin's trust. So I just wanted to clarify on that issue. I think the fundamental disagreement here between appellant and respondent is the interpretation of this trust. This is an inter vivos trust. By its terms, it was designed to dispose of property upon Nathan Goodwin's death. And as I go through in our brief, if you look at the various articles, that's exactly what is intended. Article 3 of the trust states, upon my death, the trustees shall make distributions from the trust assets, including all property that becomes distributable to the trustee at my death. It then says what needs to be paid first, federal estate taxes, expenses of the last illness and funeral, valid debts, expenses of administering the estate, real estate taxes. Thereafter, all the payments, once those are made, you go to the final allocation of assets under Article 4 of this agreement. Again, that says the trust assets, including all property that becomes distributable to the trustee at my death, shall be allocated and distributed as follows. If my wife does not survive me, then we will all remaining trust assets, which I give to my trustees to be administered and distributed as provided in Article 6. Article 6 goes on to say that if my wife does not survive me, the family share shall be distributed as follows. In the third amendment to the trust instruments, this is essentially giving Suzanne Stevens, respondent, a non-divided 1/4 share, trustee John Goodwin, an undivided 1/4 share, to Nancy Doucette, and a 1/4 undivided share to appellant's grandchildren. Article 8, interestingly, which is where the option is contained, talks about the trustee needing to do distribute the trust assets, as is reasonably necessary, even if that has to occur after termination of the trust. So all of these provisions, and when we're looking at what the intent of the trust is, we look at the whole instrument, not a particular article. All of these together, including, as the court noted, the provisions in the option about it only is triggered upon the death of the surviving spouse, and the fact that the appraisal is based on, the fair market value is based on the federal estate tax, the final accounting there, all of these suggest that this is in fact an inter vivos trust and that Nathan Goodwin's death triggered the option. The idea that somehow the option can remain open despite all of these other provisions that are saying this needs to be allocated and distributed upon my death, it's not a reasonable reading of the trust instrument as a whole.
Ms. Cawley, I mean, it was helpful for you to walk through the different provisions about what happens after Nathan's death, but all of those things are actions that it was the trustee's responsibility to take those actions, correct? And the trustee did not take them prior to the court proceedings, correct?
Despite the request of the beneficiaries, that is my understanding, yes.
And so, it seems odd to impose upon the grantee of an option the obligation to take the initiative to dispose of assets that the trustee is not taking any action to dispose of. Isn't there something kind of incongruous about putting the onus on a beneficiary or on a person with a right to acquire an option to purchase to force them to take the first step in exercising the option before the trustee has ever indicated an intention to distribute assets?
I don't believe it is, and here's why. I think if you have a dilatory trustee, someone, and I'm not saying that's necessarily the case here, but if you have, then you are essentially allowing an option holder, because of a dilatory trustee, to take precedent over the other beneficiaries, and essentially kind of hold the trust assets hostage. And in this case, that's particularly relevant because the evidence in the record is that, in fact, they knew this option existed. Appellant was a trustee and had indicated on the record in court that he was well familiar with the trust documents, the wills, and the intentions of the testators. So, and his attorney stated on the record that he knew of the option as of Nathan Goodwin's death, which was 3 years earlier. So in that case, there was in fact knowledge of it, and this comes back to an interpretive issue. I don't see the term to grant as stated in the option as indicating something other than to permit them to exercise the option. That's the plain and ordinary meaning. And what is happening here is that appellant is reading into that option provision to grant in some formal writing or some formal written offer. Well, the trust is very clear. If something has to be done in writing, it says in writing. And in fact, it actually defines what a writing must contain in Article, I believe it's 9B3. So we're reading in a term, or appellant's reading in a term, that it has to be in writing. And that's what they argued below. Well, there had to have been some written notice of this. That's not required under the trust. And they had actual knowledge of it. The affirmative action.
So Ms. Colley, I'm looking at the language. It says, I direct that my trustees shall grant to each of my sons, Rodney and John, the first right and option to purchase. So the trustees shall grant that language. How do the trustees accomplish that? How do they grant the right and option?
Well, they grant it when it's exercised. I mean, there was knowledge of it. But the affirmative act under the option is on the option holders. It says very clearly they have to exercise the option.
And where does it say that?
Sorry, I'm looking for it.
Yeah,
if both of my sons exercise this option to purchase any such farmlands, so the affirmative act is for them to exercise this option.
But that doesn't necessarily say that they must take the first step. I mean, that could be read, and I think perhaps should be read, to, you know, if after the trustees grant the option, then they choose to exercise. I mean, that's one way to interpret that paragraph, correct?
I don't disagree that that is one way to interpret it. I think the issue I take is that putting some technical meaning on the term grant, which, if we're supposed to be interpreting this according to its plain and ordinary meaning, grant is, it's to permit. It's not as an affirmative act. That is a definition, but it is not the primary definition of grant. And so I think you would be, and then I think appellant is writing into that to grant in writing. And again, the trust is quite clear. If something needs to be, the trustee needs to do something in writing, it says that, and it actually defines what is a writing, what needs to be contained in a writing that would comport with the writing requirement in the trust. So I believe they're reading in an extra term there. And that was what was argued below. Well, we didn't get anything in writing. And that's why they're saying this July 29th, 2022 letter, which actually didn't even offer or tender the option, but they're saying that was the writing that triggered my ability to exercise the option. I just want to also point out, I think this is an important part of the timeline, that at the May 25th, 2022 hearing, which is the one that was saying we're going to distribute the assets based on the verified petition, appellant agreed to the sale at that point. And he, in fact, was indicating, well, if we're going to sell, we have to get rid of this drainage tile easement. He said we're not at cross purposes. And so if you're looking at reasonableness to agree to the sale, at the hearing, the hearing where if you were going to object, you had to file before or raise it at the hearing per the notice and order of hearing on the April 8th notice. And there was no such objection made. And then, in fact, the discussion on the record is all about let's proceed with this sale. So I think if you're looking at just the reasonable and the equitable components, that's problematic for appellant. And I realize I'm out of time, so appreciate the court's questions.
Judge Gaitis, could I ask one follow-up question?
Yes, you may. Go ahead.
Ms. Clark, so my understanding is that at the time of that hearing, and maybe there were two preliminary hearings, I can't remember exactly, but at the time the district court was speaking, the option, it seems like the district court acknowledged that the option had not yet expired. He said it's something like, you know, given the December 31 deadline, that, you know, I think the judge said something like it will expire soon, but am I correct in understanding that at that time, at that hearing, it was understood by the judge, at least, that the option had not yet expired. And then it seems like there was a pretty short period of time after that, where the judge ruled, or perhaps the court ruled through a different judge, that it had expired. How does that make sense? I mean, is it your position that the reasonable period of time, which is a little bit of a vague term, the reasonable period had not yet expired by the time of that first hearing, but it had expired by the time of the motion proceedings and the district court's final ruling. Is that the way we should interpret the record?
I'm just going to clarify, because I think the statement from the judge at the first hearing was something more to the effect of, given the December 31st, 2022 deadline, it seems like we might be getting close to the reasonable period. I saw it was I would say less committal than that's how I recall it. I don't have it in front of me.
But to me, getting close means it's in the future. It's somewhere in the future, not far in the future, but it's still in the future, right? In other words, it wasn't already expired. It was still in existence, not yet expired when the judge spoke. Is that a fair reading of that statement?
Yes, although that's not incorporated into a finding in the order. I think it was more of an off-the-cuff statement. I think, to answer your question, if I may, I know I'm out of time. The position is the death is the triggering event. And this was 3 years after the death, and no, there had been no indication that the option was going to be exercised at the May 25th, 2022 hearing. In fact, it appeared on the record that everyone was in agreement that their sale would proceed. And then thereafter, respondent brought a motion on August 1st to prohibit the exercise of the option, at which point I believe on the very next day, the appellant attempted to exercise the option. And again, I provide the context of that first hearing because I think it's important that there was no objection to the verified petition, which sought to distribute all of the assets, including the farmland, and that the notice and order was very clear that if you were going to object, you needed to file something in advance of that hearing or raise the argument at the hearing. And as I read the transcript, appellant appeared to be in agreement that the land needed to be sold. So I provided that more contextually, but to answer your question, I believe the option, the reasonable amount of time passed during that 3 year period. And for all the equitable reasons the court was entitled to consider based on under the trust code.
If I may follow up just on that last point briefly, did appellant, you're saying he agreed to a sale. Did he agree to a sale to someone else, or did he just agree that now was the time for a sale? Because that could be consistent with his later exercise of the option to purchase, which is a way of inducing the trust to sell, but to him.
The and I am going to say this is probably my interpretation of the record, so I don't want to put any words in anyone's mouth, but if you read the transcript, it was, we are not at cross purposes, it's time for the sale, we need to clear up this, we need to get quiet title. This is appellant's point that he made on two occasions in the record. We got to get this drainage tile easement issue cleared up if we're going to have clear title to sell. Sure, that could possibly be interpreted as he was talking about a sale to himself, but there was no reference to the exercise of the option. And in fact, there was a discussion about whether that issue needed to be briefed, and that did not trigger appellant to indicate when he's talking about a sale that he was talking about a sale to himself. Thank you.
Thank you for your argument. And you never thought we'd get to you, Mr. Braun, but here we are. You'll have 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. Thomas Braun on behalf of John Goodwin. And we share a similar opinion as the respondent that the death of Nathan Goodwin is the triggering event for this option to be exercised. And really, the way that the trusts are structured, any other interpretation would be inconsistent with the testator's intention that the beneficiaries share equally in the proceeds from the sale of this property. And I think that the district court kind of took that approach when it looked at how do you deal with the lack of clarity regarding the triggering event. The court looked at the harm that would be imposed to the other beneficiaries in the event that the triggering mechanism was not the death, and that the trustee could hold the property for years on end and exercise that option at the detriment of the other beneficiaries. And that's essentially what would happen here in the event that the court finds that there has to be a tendering of the option, an offer to purchase, despite the fact that appellant knew he had the option to purchase. And I think that that actual knowledge that he had a right to purchase the property and then slumbered on that right for 3 years, which created this discrepancy of approximately $1.2 million while the property passively appreciates while held by the trust. If he were to exercise that option, he would have an instant equity position of almost $1.2 million that would come at the detriment of the other beneficiaries. So I think that the court looked at that, the timing of this, and concluded that the option must vest at the time of death. Any other result would treat the beneficiaries unequally. And I think that that's inconsistent with the terms of the trust. And we're looking at overall intent of the trustee or the testator, excuse me. I think that that conclusion is consistent with the testator's desire.
Mr. Braun,
yes.
isn't your client, at least in part, also responsible for that delay during that three-year period?
He is. He was trustee. And I think that he, took the position, is taking the position now. Well, he took it previously that the option window had closed. But if the appellant's right of option is still, for some reason, valid, then his should be too. But I think he's accepting of the district court's determination that that reasonable timeframe, to exercise the option has lapsed. And that's why he didn't ultimately exercise his option and only did so in response to the appellant's actions.
So the relevant paragraph of the trust agreement says, I direct that my trustee shall grant to each of my sons the first right and option to purchase. And so did your client do that?
He did, by the nature of making that information available and giving the appellant the actual knowledge of his ability to exercise that option. Had appellant come forward in a reasonable time frame and said, I want to exercise that option, it's a shall. There is no discretion to the trustee at that point. But I think that it's imperative to understand that because of the time delay here, what that does is it creates this large inequity to the other beneficiaries. And initially, he was not exercising his option because of what impact that would have on the other beneficiaries due to this passive appreciation.
I don't understand the prejudice to the other beneficiaries. I mean, if the price is fixed at a price that reflects the value at the date of death, why does it matter whether whether the contract is executed, say in 2019 versus 2022. And I'm sure your answer is that, the 10-year period of payments on the contract for deed would then happen earlier rather than later. It would be paid off at an earlier date rather than a later date. So there's, but it's the same amount. It's just a payment stream over a different period of time. Is there any other prejudice? In other words, the fact that the property has changed value is irrelevant because the price is fixed. If the price were, I don't know, I'm sorry to, that I'll go back to my original question. If you can tell me how the other beneficiaries are prejudiced other than receiving the payment stream at a delayed time period.
Yeah, well, they're not getting the fair market value of the property at the time of the sale. So if the
but property they wouldn't, sold, but they would not either. I mean, if he had exercised in 2019, you know, promptly, very soon after the death, they would not get the value appreciation either. Correct. So there's no difference between his being Rodney purchasing in 2019 versus 2022. Same price.
May I just respond to that question?
Of course. Yeah.
Thank you. So if the court's decision is affirmed and the option is not valid, the property will sell for essentially fair market value today. So despite the fact that the property could have been purchased for $3.03 million then, the sale now will produce something well in excess of $4 million. So I understand the court's logic behind, well, the sale price, the date of valuation is what it was at the time of the death of the testator. However, the actual sale now will be at fair market value, and that's where this large windfall ultimately would come in. So thank you very much.
Thank you for your argument. And now we'll go back to Mr. Bellick. You will have 5 minutes for a rebuttal argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to start by first going back to Suzanne Stevens' counsel's remarks about Articles 3 and 4. And how, in their view, that indicates that everything should be distributed at the date of death. If you look at Article 3, paragraph C, it says all payments under the preceding provisions of this article shall be made prior to the final allocation of assets under Article 4. Then you go to Article 4. Article 4 talks about the handling of the assets, and it doesn't just say allocated, it talks about as well administered. So the purpose of this trust was to hold assets so long as the beneficiaries didn't have a problem with it, to be administered so they can receive the rental income as they did. If you look at Article 3 and 4, nothing in those provisions explicitly imposes an obligation on the trustees to liquidate the trust at the time of death, because that's not the purpose of the trust. And so you can't use those articles to read in a date of death deadline with respect to the option.
So, Mr. Bellick, it sounds like you actually agree with the statement that Ms. Colley made at the outset of her argument, that really the fundamental question in this case is, what kind of trust are we dealing with? Is this a testamentary type of trust, or is it something that is expected to endure? Do you agree? Do you agree that that's really the question before us?
If it is the question before you, the trust answers it in the protective provisions. And that would be, get the article number here. Article 9, paragraph C, protective provisions, then subparagraph 5 talks about the perpetuity of the trust. And so the purpose of this trust is to go on for decades if the beneficiaries have no objection to it. So you can answer that question on the terms of the trust. The other point I want to make is, if the court resolves the legal question as to the trigger timing with respect to the options, let's say it's date of death, if the court agrees with that, then the question is, as counsel has talked about, reasonableness and equity. And that's part three of the analysis I mentioned at the beginning of my arguments, is now you're into a factual question. Reasonableness, equities, all relate to facts. And that's going to require a remand for trial, because there are no facts on the record here. Counsel has mentioned the verified petition. If you look at the case law cited in our brief, verified petitions are not evidence until they are formally offered at a hearing and subject to cross-examination and contested witnesses. That never happened here. They mentioned a requirement that there be a formal written objection. Again, as mentioned in our brief, that is not required under the trust code. They cannot cite a statutory provision under the trust code for that. And if you go back to the initial hearing, the understanding of the parties was that the option was being raised for the first time at that hearing. In fact, it was John Goodwin himself who had apparently indicated that he might be interested in exercising that. That was not raised until the first hearing and then was set on for further briefing. So there was no expectation that that would be a triggering event or anything like that. The expectation was as this would be talked about in the future. The petitioner, the moving party, Ms. Stevens, has the burden to prove the facts on the equities, and she didn't offer any evidence. The verified petition was not offered. There was no opportunity for cross-examination. My colleague, who was present at that time, made several comments to the court about you can't be making decisions without evidence. You can't be doing that, Your Honor. You can't rely on the statements of counsel. So if you get to the point where you say date of death is the trigger, then we're on remand for trial to talk about reasonableness. As Judge Johnson points out, one of the big things related to reasonableness is that the trustee, if everything was to be distributed at date of death, didn't act. And the district court didn't address that issue. And that creates a logic problem. And illogical orders are an abuse of discretion as a matter of law. And it's not just that they're with respect to prejudice and what the court didn't appreciate and needed to address in its order, was that not only is it irrelevant that the value of the land is increased, but with respect to prejudice, it was undisputed, at least in the arguments of counsel, that the beneficiaries received income by sitting on their hands and in not acting pursuant to what, if this court reads, is an imperative that everything be distributed at death. So that's an illogic, a fatal illogic to the court's order.
Counsel, how's that illogical when these parents wanted to treat their children equally, basically, and the position you're advocating for does anything but treat them equally?
The parents did not want to treat their children equally. This trust agreement is very common in rural Minnesota.
I understand that. It's a misogynistic world out there in the farmland. You know that.
Yeah, they wanted their sons to have a first shot at the farmland.
Even though they weren't farming it.
Excuse me? I didn't hear you.
Even though they were not farming it, apparently.
Apparently, the parents didn't consider that as a factor, but as the court will note in the arguments of counsel below, again, there's no evidence, but the arguments of counsel was that Rodney Goodwin is, in fact, running I believe it's a hog farm. I'd have to double check the arguments, but he is running an operation on some of this land. And I'm out of time.
Judge Gaetis, could I hesitate to do so a second time, but could I ask for a little bit of extra time to ask one more question?
I'll give you a wee bit of extra time.
Thank you. Mr. Bellick, I guess at the beginning of your rebuttal, I thought you said that the trust could operate in perpetuity or something like that. But if I look at the first paragraph of Article 3, it says, upon my death, the trustees shall make distributions from the trust assets, including all property that becomes distributable to the trustees at my death. So I understood, based on that language, that it was the trustees' obligation, you know, obviously not on the day of death, but thereafter, to distribute the assets of the trust to the beneficiaries and wrap up the trust. Am I wrong about that?
The question is when, and so you have to go further. So you're reading the preamble to Article 3, and it has at the end there, comma, as follows, and you go to subpart C, and it talks about a final allocation pursuant to Article 4. And then you go to Article 4, and Article 4 talks about not just distribution, but administration.
It does, but in the first paragraph of Article 4, it says the trust assets, including all property that becomes distributable to the trustees at my death, shall be allocated and distributed as follows. So it seems to me that even 3 and 4 working together indicate that, you know, again, maybe not the next day, but at least shortly thereafter the death. I mean, that seems different. That seems inconsistent with a trust that operates indefinitely, in perpetuity.
Your Honor's use of the term shortly thereafter is adding language to the trust agreement that doesn't exist. So that's problematic. They don't provide a deadline. This is the quintessential essence of these trusts, that the beneficiaries can continue to receive benefits until there's a final allocation. When is that final allocation? It's basically in this agreement, because there's no specific provision, and we can't add the language or shortly after my death because it doesn't exist there. It's when the beneficiaries petition for that to happen. And they didn't do that. They reaped the benefits for several years and seemed to be okay with that, and then realized suddenly, well, now I want a lump sum distribution. And that's, again, what's going to go into the equities and what needs to be tried and subject to cross-examination if you hold a date of death trigger. Okay. We need in and have a trial on that equity issue and reasonableness issue.
Thank you, Mr. Bellick.
All right. That concludes the arguments in this case. Thank you very much. Your arguments were very helpful. The case is now submitted to us, and we will issue our decision within the next 90 days. You're now all free to leave should you choose to do so. And shortly, we will commence the second argument on our calendar.